countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
This is not an end, but a beginning. This is the moment when the dawn breaks and the curtain goes up on a new act in our great national drama. We want this to be the beginning of a new era of friendly cooperation between the EU and an energetic Britain, a Britain that is simultaneously a great European power and truly global in our range and ambitions.
Boris Johnson, British Prime Minister, speaking last night about Brexit. Yes, this is the morning after the Brexit night before. In June 2016, the United Kingdom decided to leave the European Union, and at 11 p.m. last night, their membership formally ended. We are now in a transition period in the relationship between the United Kingdom and our European neighbours, and many complex issues remain to be resolved in the course of 2020. And if you're farming or if you have an exporting business, what happens next is really, really important. I'm joined in studio by Phelim O'Neill of the Irish Farmers Journal and a proud Tyrone man as well.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning, Phelim. You've been writing on the issue since Brexit was an unthinkable possibility until last night, when it became a reality. So what has changed overnight, Phelim?
Well, I suppose, Marty, everything has changed, yet nothing has changed. The UK formally left the EU last night at 11 o'clock our time, 12 o'clock in Brussels. They move in, as you say, to this transition period. And I suppose it's now that it gets real. This period, up until the end of this year, as the UK says, although there's the option to extend it, will be used to try and negotiate a new trading relationship to replace the European Union. Now, I suppose from an Irish farmer's perspective, the difficulty here is, from a trade point of view, the European Union, the single market, if you like, was the perfect egg. Mm. The UK leaving the European Union smashes that egg. And now creating a future trading deal and a new trading relationship is trying to put the egg back together again. Mm. And I suppose the view that we would have in the Farmers' Journal is, it's impossible to recreate the perfect egg once you've broken it.
I can see your point. Obviously now the negotiations over a future trade agreement can really start.
That's it. And I suppose this is the real critical phase. And again, what we need here from an Irish farming point of view, and indeed an Irish industry point of view in the wider sense, is as close as we could possibly get to the single market that the UK had been in. To achieve that requires the UK to remain very much aligned to European rules and European standards. And that is the great fear, because we have heard Boris Johnson talk about this new dawn and this next act and all of that. If the UK diverge from European standards, then the reality of that is that there will be greater barriers, greater inspections required. Trade with the UK will be much more difficult. And, you know, the risk is that is what is going to happen, because the UK have great ambitions to do trade deals with the United States, with the rest of the world. And the trouble is the United States standards and European standards are quite different, and the European Union will not tolerate the UK doing a deal with the States and give them a very favourable one in return.
But there won't be checks between the Republic and Northern Ireland, so there won't?
No, that is the one bit that has been totally sorted out now, and sorted out on a permanent basis. We used to hear an awful lot of talk about the backstop last year and the year before. That disappeared from the scene because the withdrawal agreement has effectively sorted out the Irish border issue once and for all from a trade perspective. Trade there will continue just as it is today. Northern Ireland will remain aligned to EU production standards no matter what, and they will implement EU customs and tariffs policy. And that's why we have this controversial issue of checks on product coming into Northern Ireland from Britain.
So we are where we are now. What is the choreography for the next few months?
Well, I suppose Michel Barnier, who will lead the negotiations from an EU perspective.
He was in Belfast, wasn't he?
He was in Belfast during the week, and I suppose I had the opportunity to attend that lecture they delivered at Queen's University. And I felt now, okay, there's a degree of shadow boxing takes place ahead of a negotiation, but he was particularly frank and particularly blunt in terms of what the divide would mean and the UK departure would mean in terms of checks and product going from Britain into Belfast. And here this is difficult because, again, the UK Prime Minister would take a different view on on this, whereas the EU will take the view, look, a legally binding agreement is in place, it's there in writing. And when he was challenged by the media at that Belfast event, he actually got quite irritated, you know, when he was holding up a speech and asked, did you not hear what I said? So I think it's pretty clear in terms of the future trading relationship that, that whilst the island of Ireland can continue to trade back and forward as if nothing has happened, it will certainly not be the case between the island of Ireland and Britain.
And at the farm level, how will all these issues play out, do you think?
I suppose, well, look, the farming sector, particularly on beef and sheep meat, is coming out of a very difficult year in 2019. The problem going ahead is, and again, Ireland, you know, agricultural produce is our key indigenous industry. We export 90% of what we produce on this island, both north and south. And the reality is that about half of that will go to Britain. That's our main market. Now, in some sectors, in pig meat and in dairy produce, we're very competitive at a global level. But because of EU production standards in terms of what we have to do, the environmental controls that we have to put in place, we're an expensive beef producer. Producing region. And in return for that, of course, the European Union has protected the European market with quite a high tariff wall. The UK is leaving now, so there will be two scenarios. If they impose full tariffs on Irish exports to the UK in a no-deal situation at the end of this year, that would price Irish beef out of the market. Another approach they might take is they might throw the doors open completely and create a tariff-free quota, which brings in beef from all over the world, South America, where it's a much lower cost of production, and that would obliterate the Irish beef industry as well. The Irish beef sector is the one that's particularly exposed, and if there isn't a close trading relationship and a protected UK market, then it is a really doomsday situation for the Irish beef industry this time next year.
And Phelan, when will we know the outcome of all these negotiations? How long do we actually have to wait?
Well, I suppose observing the past 3 years, if it has taught us anything, is that negotiations will take as long as they take. We are told, and the official position is, that it has to be pretty much wrapped up by the middle of the year to allow for the ratification and the approval process. That didn't happen last time round, and it's very much, and I suppose deals tend to get done very late in the day. And I suppose if there is any consolation, this, we've had the opportunity to speak to Sir Jonathan Fall, who was, would have led the task force prior to the referendum for negotiation with the EU or with the UK, and he was hopeful that, you know, that sense would prevail, because UK industry is absolutely dependent on the EU for trade, and the hope would be, and again, I suppose the UK Prime Minister, he's quite a flamboyant character, but he has also shown himself to be very pragmatic in negotiation, and I suppose from the Irish farming point of view, we'd be hoping that that pragmatism is what defines a negotiation for the rest of this year, and they remain closely aligned to the EU.
And finally, Phelan, in the meantime, what are beef farmers doing to figure out their future?
Well, I suppose the difficulty is, and you know, we hear so much about diversification, we hear so much about developing new markets, and we are, and last year we would have our dependency in the UK reduced by 5%. We have opened the Chinese market and there is some business there. But look, the reality of life, there's a huge portion of Irish land that's suitable for suckler and sheep farming. It's not suitable for transfer to dairying or anything else, and therefore we need a sustainable beef industry in the long term.
Well, Phelan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. That's Phelan O'Neill from the Irish Farmers Journal. Now, farmers and environmentalists sometimes find themselves on opposite sides of the fence when climate change and the biodiversity crisis are being discussed. This week, the Irish Wildlife Trust is organising a conference in County Waterford to start a conversation between farmers and environmentalists to find common ground. Amongst the speakers is James Foley, a conventional dairy farmer in County Waterford. He's bringing about a change in the grass he grows to feed his herd. He believes that these changes will make his operation more financially efficient, will reduce greenhouse gases, improve water quality, and contribute to greater biodiversity. Sounds good. Well, Ella McSweeney went along to meet James and walk the fields.
I'm just feed the autumn born calves with a little bit of hay there now. And they'd probably be glad to see us now.
It's feeding time for the five-month-old calves on James Foley's dairy farm outside of Dungarvan in County Waterford.
This is a pretty new shed. This was built in 2018. Sorry.
Oh, my lord. Wow.
They're all Holstein Friesians. They were born in October and November mostly.
Big long legs on them.
You're just forking the hay towards them.
This is hay that I made in the drought in 2018. I have a load of bales of hay, so lucky enough, I don't normally make hay.
James has 180 cows on 265 acres, and like nearly all farmers, his fields were full of one species of grass, ryegrass, which the cows would eat. But ryegrass depends on nitrogen fertilisers to grow well, and this costs money and can cause nitrogen pollution in the environment. James was spending about €25,000 a year on artificial fertiliser, so in 2018 he decided to save money and move away from ryegrass. But what to plant? Well, after some research, he found his answer.
I had never actually considered growing herbs and legumes and grasses all together. I just hadn't even considered it because it just wasn't part of our education. My interest was piqued when I read an article from one of the UK farming magazines. They were growing a mixture of species of plants rather than what we do here, which is basically ryegrass monoculture. Which is what you see around 95% of the farms around the country. I kind of looked into it more. I tried to look into the science of it because it appeared that you can actually get a better yield when you mix species together rather than having one species. The main ones are chicory, plantain. In the legumes end of things, you're talking about red clover, white clover, bird's foot trefoil. In the grasses, and you're talking timothy and cocksfoot. They can actually produce the same amount of feed without any nitrogen. When you spread a bag of nitrogen, you know, you'd be lucky if it got 50% efficiency, and that would be definitely on a good day. And where the rest goes is some of it goes into water, you know, soaks down through the ground and eventually ends up in our groundwater, or it can volatilize into the atmosphere, which is greenhouse gases. Farmers are under the pump at the moment from all sides of the media. And this is a positive story. I'm totally happy with it as well. I've been growing these here since 2018, and I will be converting as fast as possible.
So far, 10% of James's land is sowed with multi-species plants. Within 5 years, he hopes to have all his fields converted. This also means he'll cut out nitrogen fertiliser altogether. So the tree has come down here.
This tree, this beech tree fell a couple of weeks ago in one of those storms.
So we'll just swing around it so we don't have to climb over it. And then in front of us are just huge, huge fields. Wow, they're big.
Yeah.
Is the electric fence on?
No.
Step over the electric fence. So the field that we're in at the moment is clearly ryegrass.
There is a bit of white clover in it, but it's kind of hard to see it at the moment. The white clover tends to die back a little bit during the winter.
And if we go across the cow path here,
I'll
just step over again.
Species sward now.
I mean, you know, even my unfarmery eye can see that that's very different. So it's a field, this is the multi-species sward, and it's a field that's got kind of white straggly bits in it.
Yeah.
I would say a lot of farmers would look at that and say, that looks a bit untidy, James.
Yeah, that's, I suppose, you're not going to, you know, your farm isn't going to look like a golf course. You kind of have to get over that.
We'll just go over here. There's some chicory there, is it?
Yeah, there's some chicory, and there's some cocksfoot there close enough as well. It's more of a clumpy grass. It's kind of, it's what they call a bunch grass. But that's got a very, very deep root. But it actually has... It stores up energy for the spring, so it actually has quite early spring growth, as you can see, in comparison to the ryegrass field beside it. The cocksfoot is actually sticking up. It's growing very well at this stage of the season.
And so when, you know, essentially what happens is when you get into this field and you look down, what there is diversity. I mean, there's just a whole different variety of plant species there.
Yeah, some of them are actually not even visible at the moment, but they will appear over different times of the year. Some of them come up in the summertime, some of them are spring and some of them are more autumn.
When you put the cows on it, is there a difference in their reaction, or is that a silly question?
At first, I suppose they were looking at the chicory a little bit. It's a new plant for them. They're not used to it. But after the second or third grazing, they'd nearly break the wire to get into it, you know.
Really?
So,
And why is that?
Chicory in particular has a lot of minerals in it. Because of its deep roots, it's able to bring up minerals up to the surface that we'd say the likes of ryegrass can't reach. I don't know, do you want to taste a bit of it?
Yeah, sure.
You can actually put this in your salad. Just taste so the stem of it there.
So there's a chicory leaf here. It looks a little bit like a dandelion leaf.
Yeah.
I suppose you'd say, right? I'm going to try it now.
It's a broad leaf.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very strong flavour, isn't it?
Very strong flavour, yeah. Farms are private places. This is a private enterprise. Yeah. But why should the general public, the non-farmers out there, care about whether you have monoculture ryegrass or what they call this multi-species sward? What difference would it make to them, if any?
If you want cleaner water and you want, you know, clean atmosphere and, you know, better food, I would say. If cows are on this kind of a diet, it can supply everything. It can help with biodiversity, it can help with the clean water because of less nitrogen use and less greenhouse gas emissions. So the general public, I would say, would love this. This one is an easy enough win-win for farmers and the environment, in my opinion.
And that was James Foley speaking to Ella McSweeney. That conference called Farming and the Environmental Crisis is on in the Greenway Manor Hotel Waterford on this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And good news, it's free. Today is the start of the Dublin Racing Festival, where over 200 horses will thrill the crowds at Leopardstown today and tomorrow. Pedigree is really important in the horse racing industry, but are thoroughbred horses at risk from being too inbred? It's a trend that could threaten Ireland's valuable breeding sector, according to a new study carried out by UCD and Equine Science Business Plus Vital. Now, Suzanne Campbell joins us to look over the research. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you on the programme.
I know, and it's a fantastic weekend of racing. I won't be there today, but I'll be there tomorrow to see Fohine. Very, very exciting. And we know that thoroughbreds are a huge, huge business in Ireland. It's a €2 billion sector. It employs around 29,000 people in rural jobs, according to Deloitte. So the health and the good name of our thoroughbred horses is really important. And this new research examined the DNA of 10,000 racehorses across the world, actually, in America and Japan, Australia and in Europe, and looked at the rise of inbreeding in the population of thoroughbred horses. And as we know, it's an issue with many animals, you know, with farm animals, with pets, with food animals and with horses as well. And what it does is it can compromise animals' health and their fertility as well. The head of this project and this research is UCD Professor Dr. Emmeline Hill, related to Charmaine Hill, of course, who was the famous owner of Dawn Run, the legendary mare. And Emmeline is the scientist who identified the speed gene in horses a decade ago. And her work was really, really groundbreaking. And she's further developed this technology to look at DNA in more detail. And this study is the first of its kind. So I asked her first about its origins.
We've been collecting samples, DNA samples from horses for the last 15, 20 years from various research projects in Trinity College, first of all, and then in my own research in UCD, and then more recently over the last 10 or 15 years in Equinome and Plus Vital. We have over 10,000 horses that have their entire genomes profiled at this point. So what that means is that we have genetic information for almost 500,000 units of DNA that covers the entire genome. That is the largest DNA resource for thoroughbreds anywhere in the world. And one of the patterns that we were interested in was, are there differences in the level of inbreeding in the population over time, or has inbreeding changed over time, or the diversity of the population changed over time? And because we had samples that go back as far as the 1970s, 1980s, we had a 45-year time period in which we could look at that pattern. So using this genetic information, we have shown that over the course of 45 years, the gene pool of the thoroughbred has dramatically narrowed and genomic inbreeding has increased significantly over the last 45 years. And probably the greatest increase has been in the last 10 or 20 years.
Recording the thoroughbred horse population is a very old, perhaps one of the oldest recordings of any animal. Am I right about that?
Exactly. Funnily enough, horses and hounds, they've been recorded for longer than people, Marty.
Really?
Us, yes.
And I've read that remember somewhere.
Yeah, unless your royalty are very special, your birth really didn't matter. But horses descended from, thoroughbred horses descended from three animals that came from kind of the Middle East and Turkey, and they were considered so special that all the mares mated to them were recorded in all their offspring, and that became the modern thoroughbred stud book, of which there's about 300,000 horses around the world. And it's a closed stud book. You can't add more animals into it. You can only have the genetics that are within it repeating themselves in a way. And they've been bred, of course, for one overall trait, for athleticism. But in the last decades, we've seen a narrowing of the diversity in the thoroughbred cohort, because what's happened is in the 1970s and 1980s, a stallion would only cover 40 mares. And that was the kind of scheme, was syndication. Now it can be hundreds of mares a year. So you get one really special stallion and he mates with mares in the northern hemisphere one half of the year, in the southern hemisphere the other half of the year. So you get this collecting of certain horses that are really dominant in the gene pool. Mm. So I asked Dr. Beatrice McGivney from the project about the role of these horses in that narrowing of diversity in the gene pool.
What we did see is that 97% of the horses in our data set all trace back to Northern Dancer, the single sire Northern Dancer. But what I found is also interesting is that 55% of European horses trace back to Sadler's Wells, who is a son of Northern Dancer. And approximately, I think it's a third of Australian horses trace back to Dane Hill, another progeny of Northern Dancer. So that accentuates the point that it's not even that they all trace back to Northern Dancer. The horses are tracing back to a very small number of Northern Dancer progeny. Work on this project has been ongoing since 2018. And future work that we're looking at is working from this, the development of molecular tools that can be used to measure horses inbreeding and look at mating horses, where you can measure how related two horses are and use that information to look at the implications of that.
Tell us more about this horse, Northern Dancer.
Northern Dancer, he's probably one of the most famous racehorses ever. He was Canadian born. He won the Kentucky Derby in the Preakness States in North America. The key to his success really is one of his sons, well, several of his sons, but one in particular, Sadler's Wells. Sadler's Wells was a foaled in the US, brought by Robert Sangster over to Vincent O'Brien. Vincent O'Brien had multiple classic wins with him. And Sadler's Wells was at stud in Ireland until 2011. Now, he died age 30, so he wouldn't have been seeing mares at the end of his life, but he covered an awful lot of mares. He was the father of Galileo, who's probably the most desirable sire in the world at the moment. Galileo was the father of Frankel. So you can see how
There's pedigree, literally
three in a row, three sires in a row that are some of the most famous and the most prolific in the world. And I suppose the implications of these dominant lines, we don't know how clear cut they are, you know, but what inbreeding suggests is an increase in, you know, health problems and fertility down the line. We know that where you have genetic copies that are very alike in a mare and a stallion, it can hide mutations. And so they're lurking there. So Emmeline Hill and Plus Vital have developed technology where you can send them a sample, a DNA sample from your horse, and you can test for traits, even the speed gene. You can test for how closely related they might be to a stallion you want to match them with. And trying to avoid inbreeding is going to be more important in the long term. It's going to be difficult for breeders who operate under commercial conditions. You know, if you've the opportunity and if you've the money to send your horse, your mare to Frankel, but maybe she's a bit too related to Frankel, you might be better off going to a second tier stallion. But I mean, that's a commercial force, and it's going to be difficult for the industry to deal with, but something that Emmeline Hill thinks is pretty vital for the breed.
What the genetic tools can do will allow breeders to identify outcrosses or more genetically distant stallions that they might not have previously considered. So really what it's about is about giving people more choice, informing breeders about the potential risks of breeding close relationships in terms of the immediate risks to their own operations and breeding operations. But more generally, to consider the long-term sustainability of the breed and where the breed is going to be, maybe not in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, but in 20 years and 50 years' time. I mean, this is a breed that has been very carefully managed for hundreds of years and is the pride of so many breeders and is the pride of Ireland. And so using genetic information really should be thought of as a useful tool into the future to monitor and manage our population. So we still have the best population of thoroughbreds that are revered for their brilliance all over the world.
So long may our thoroughbred record remain, and best of luck to all the horses and riders this week at Leopardstown.
Hear, hear.
Yes.
Always fascinating, Suzanne Campbell. Thank you very much for joining us on Countrywide. Now, they're warming up their concertinas in West Clare and hoping that musicians from all over Ireland will join them in 2 weeks' time for a full programme of activities at the annual Concertina Cruinniú in Milltown Malbang in West Clare. This year, a special talk will focus on women and traditional music. Dermot McIntyre popped into Friel's Pub in Milltown Malbang to find out more.
Some lovely tunes here in Friel's Pub in Milltown Malbay. And I'm joined by three musicians. Who have we got?
Liam O'Brien.
Bernadette McCarthy.
And Moira O'Keefe.
And Moira, one of the things that's coming up here in Milltown in the next couple of weeks is the Cruinniú. And you're going to be giving a lecture.
Well, we'd say it's a talk. It's actually called Kitty Gone A-Milking, which is a title of a tune. And it's really a celebration of all the women. Women in traditional music, they were always involved. I suppose the thing about women in traditional music is that it was traditional music mirrors society, really, and what happened in society. And there was times when women certainly couldn't sit in Friel's Pub and play music. It just wasn't the done thing.
It couldn't have come into Friel's Pub, probably full stop.
Probably full stop, but certainly maybe not play music. But then you go back to Kilrush and there was Mrs. Crotty playing in a pub because her husband owned the pub. So she could play in the pub and she was very well known as a concertina player. And then you had lots of women, like, I come from Kerry, so Julia Clifford stands out as a woman who learned to play music because her brother was learning to play music and her father realised she had a good musical head on her and he had her get lessons from Padraig O'Keefe.
And when you say it reflects society?
Yeah, I mean, there was a great lady in Donegal called Kitty Shan Cunningham who just passed away a few years ago. And Kitty told me a story, she was in her 90s when she died, that she had tried to play the fiddle and she knew John Doherty and she knew all these great musicians. But a neighbour said to her father, women shouldn't be playing the fiddle. And he took the fiddle off her. And she never got to play the fiddle. She knew all the tunes in her head and she could sing. We learned tunes from her. But she wasn't allowed to play the fiddle.
Yeah. Well, I was brought up in London. My father was a musician. He was very, very involved in music in London. And when he came back here, this is where he brought his children.
Were you very actively encouraged to pick up the fiddle? Because you have a lovely fiddle there. Sitting in your lap as we're chatting.
My dad had a very laid-back approach. We didn't go to formal classes, but our house was always open to musicians, travelling musicians who came to London, and my mother fed them and they stayed with us. So we learnt our music through, we were kind of sponges.
I think musical families had a huge bearing on how women played music. If the instruments were in the house, it was easier for women to play, obviously, rather than a woman to start off. And there was no instrument around, there was no culture of instruments. So musical families really and how they passed down the music was huge importance to facilitating women playing music. Women in the diaspora as well, you know, women who travelled like Lucy Farr, Julia Clifford, people who emigrated and probably had a better chance to play music publicly. But also women who were born into the diaspora. So like Liz Carl was born into a musical family. They were born into a kind of a situation where the music was being kept alive.
Yeah, like that, I'd be completely different to the ladies here because I grew up primarily around women that were playing. Like I started music learning off my mother and I says, can I play the accordion that looks like a 50 pence coin?
And that's the concertina.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bernadette and Mam used to play here every Saturday night for years and then I'd sneak away in here and play it with them and, you know, like I'm always surrounded by female musicians.
I suppose the accordions, when they were originally invented, there's some great lovely drawings of the marketing that was done to women, believe it or not, in 1829, 1830s. In Ireland, they were in Ireland in 1831, and concertinas as well, you know. And it was just marketed as an instrument that would suit women. Again, it was society, you know, women had to be demure and they had to be, you know, behave themselves. And so the melodeon was seen as something that could sit on their knee and just play very delicately.
And even that bit about the public role and the private role of women, there's been a massive shift. But how did that it particularly affect traditional music? Like you mentioned, say, about not coming into a pub, so you couldn't join in a session.
I think it was just more acceptable for men. I think of a woman called Rose O'Connor. She taught fiddle in Dundalk. She told me that her mother-in-law lived in the house with them, and she would be on the road with a Cayley band, and she'd get back in at maybe 7 o'clock in the morning, and the mother-in-law would hear her, and she'd get up, and she'd come down, and Rose would pretend she was loading the washing machine, that she was up for ages, and she was only in the door. Like, take sessions. I think of sessions in Dublin where there might have been very few women playing in them. It was always more acceptable, I think, for men to sit playing a session all night and the girlfriend to sit at the bar waiting for them than it was the other way around if the male didn't play music. So it was society. It was the way society perceived things. And it has changed, thankfully.
I think it might be time for a tune to play us out. What are you going to give us?
Fields of America.
Fields of America.
I'd associate it with Mam and Bernadette. I just know you used to play that here on a Saturday night.
So we call these Bernadette and Breeds.
Yes, reminds me of home. Musicians Liam O'Brien, whose Mum Breed, of course, is one of Ireland's greatest musicians, Bernadette McCarthy and Maura O'Keefe, playing out that lovely report by Diarmaid McIntyre of Grey Heron Media. And Maura's talk, Kitty's Gone A-Milking, illustrated with live music, takes place as part of the Concertina Cruinniú in Milltown Malbang from the 14th to the 16th of February. And there's more information on concertinacruinniú.ie. Now, here's a question. What do Ankara, Athens, Washington or Wellington in New Zealand have in common? Well, they're among the 26 cities where Irish embassies or consulates are organising festivals to celebrate St. Bridget and Irish women's creativity and achievement. Today is, of course, the 1st of February, St. Bridget's Day. Tara Flynn is taking part in tonight's event at the London Irish Centre, and using research from her show, Not a Funny Word, Tara will be sharing her hypothesis about Bridget and butter.
We're here to celebrate Bridget, Ireland's real patron. After all, what did St. Patrick do? Wah, wah, holy hot takes, throw a parade. He banished some snakes. Except he didn't. There were no snakes. I'm not saying he's a sham, but waving a sham rock around isn't all that. They aren't even that heavy. Then there's Bridget. Not a saint, no. They made her a Christian saint later, and she became so mainstream that her cross became the emblem for the national broadcaster. But Bridget was so much more than just a holy logo. She was a Celtic goddess. She brought spring. She was a swordsmith, and not too shabby at wielding one herself. The goddess of fire and fertility and healing, with power over pregnancy, conception and labour. Goddess of poetry and light, of beer. Of all society, all classes. Goddess of multitasking, really. Forget Patrick, we should be throwing parades for her. Keep your shamrocks, lad, we're making swords. When I think of Ireland, with its poets and warriors and beers, it's Bridget I think of. There's a legend that Bridget once gave away all her family's milk, butter and cheese to the hungry. But the very next day, the dairy was magically full again. It may not have been water into wine, ale was more her style, but making butter magically multiply surely deserves a parade at the least. This dairy connection is apt, because my second image of Ireland, after Bridget, is of course rich, creamy butter. Cattle grazing in lush Kerry fields, silver churns, glistening golden packages, yellow, salty, lucrative. If all Ireland's exported butter were laid end to end, it would go three times around the world. That is a fact. Did Bridget have a hand in that? Science can't say, but I think we know the truth. How did we, the Irish historical underdogs, get to rule the world in such a delicious, spreadable way? If not a conquering of the world, at least a covering of toast. Now, I'm no historian, but I, like every other person who goes to the pub, am an expert. And here's my hypothesis. You can link every significant Irish historical event back to Bridget or butter or both.
That's Tara Flynn. Tara will also be performing in Dublin on Sunday night at the Sugar Club. There are events across the country this weekend connected with St. Bridget, particularly in Kildare and Louth, counties closely associated with her. And here in Dublin, there's a light show on the GPO to highlight women this St. Patrick's Day, organised by herstory.ie. And I'm joined in studio by Tracy O'Connor, who is among a growing number of women who want St. Bridget's Day to become a national holiday. And Suzanne Campbell has stayed with us as well. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Martin.
And you're welcome to the Countrywide Studio.
Thank you very much.
Why do you think that St. Bridget's Day should be a national holiday?
Oh, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, we haven't celebrated women in our culture and in our history in the national holidays that we have. Patrick, fair play to him, but he's from Wales. We have another couple of bank holidays. Actually, the last bank holiday that we had was in 1993 that was put in place, and that was for the May bank holiday.
Right.
They all actually celebrate, when you think about it, cross-quarter days in the old Celtic calendar, so May being the start of summer. We've got October, which is Samhain. And Bridget's Day celebrates the start of spring. And it's the best time to come out of the darkness of winter. Let's all celebrate. I can hear, can you, a collective sigh of relief across the country today, because it's such a long month.
This is a no-brainer, to be honest with you. A day off. Yeah, absolutely,
exactly.
Tracy.
Yeah.
What kind of a woman was St. Bridget?
Well, St. Bridget founded a monastery in Kildare, and it was a double monastery. It was both for men and women. You were talking earlier, Suzanne, about the curragh. And so she's very closely associated with agriculture, with horses, obviously because of the curragh, because she was there. She was a woman of heart. She loved community. She really bridged. It's in her name. She was a bridge builder, a peace activist, an environmentalist, which you were talking about earlier on as well. She was, if you think of bridging winter and spring, that is what she brings. She brings humanity and cooperation and collaboration. It's a sense of lifting people up rather than pulling them down, which is the energy of what she would bring. And she was a bit of a doer as well. Like, she wasn't just she was of heart, but she was of sound mind as well. Like, she stood up to the King of Leinster at one stage and threw her cloak over. You know, he said, "You can have as much land as your cloak can cover." So off she went with her maidens and got them each to take a bit of her cloak and spread it across the land, and it became the curragh, and that was her land. So she didn't take no for an answer.
She was a leader way back then.
She was
ahead of her time. Suzanne, what do you think of Tracy's idea of St. Bridget?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, if you look at Europe, they celebrate much more. I think regional saints and people of importance, more than we do, in a way. And I think she definitely deserves a feast day. My father is from the northwest. My parents are from the north, Fermanagh, Tyrone, Donegal area. And we always made, you've brought in a Bridget's Cross. We always made Bridget's Crosses today, and I will be doing it later on. I live in a very rushy area, so it suits. So you nip outside. We don't have to go far. Bring in the rushes, and my kids make them. And there's something really nice. And I do like the kind of woo-hoo superstition kind of aspect to those saints as well. I like to have one in the house. I like to feel there's some kind of connection to that mythic past and to Christianity and to early Christianity as well. And those, I think those stories are enduring, and her identity is enduring because of a reason, because there's something that we attach to in that, because it has a power. And that is a thing we can't create anymore, you know, but it's something very special and unique.
Yeah.
And I think definitely we need a new feast day for St. Bridget.
Stories are passed on from, you know, the ancestors and from our past, and especially in rural areas where they really believed that Bridget was protector of the herds. They would put a Bridget's cross over the cattle shed.
We had it with our house.
Absolutely. And you remember that.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And you don't question that. It's like the fairy trees. You don't cut them down.
And you're an interfaith minister ordained in 2017.
Yeah, Tracy. What does that mean?
Interfaith
minister is somebody who is of service in a ministry of service, attached to no religion in particular, but all faiths and none. So for me, my biggest faith is in nature and the cycles of nature and how we can follow that back to simplicity, and which Bridget would have adhered to as well. Simplicitas
bestis. Follow her in every sense.
Yeah.
If listeners think that they might like to support the idea of a national holiday to celebrate St. Bridget, how can they do this?
Yeah, there's a petition on myuplift.ie. And just, yeah, put in Make Bridget's Day a national holiday.
The campaign
Let's
started
make it happen.
On Countrywide.
Yeah, thank
Tracy O'Connor, thank you very much. Suzanne, thank you indeed for staying with us as
Thanks,
well.
Marty.